and thinking about making the mind more inward. The yogis, thousands of years ago, discovered the relationship between mind and breath. And a very simple experiment you can do is to simply begin to breathe with your stomach, meaning when you breathe in, your stomach slightly rises. When you breathe out, your stomach slightly contracts. And that means that your diaphragm is working more completely. That most oftentimes, when we breathe shallowly, using just the top 10% of our lungs. But that when we breathe more completely, we notice a state of relaxation versus a state of chronic tension. You feel a flow of life energy in a way that you didn't before. Your mind becomes calm and relaxed. Just this one simple method of breathing to your stomach have helped asthmatics not to become symptomatic. Have helped nervous disorders be completely erased. Training the body to breathe with the stomach. Fighter pilots learned that when they were taking high G forces, they would hold the stomach. And as we know from the clearing and charging exercises, this is a charging system, and it would force the blood to the extremities and keep the pilot from passing out. So breath, body, and mind all work together. So to achieve a calm, alert, relaxed state, breathing with the stomach. A more relaxed, full, complete breath. Another technique that we're taught is to put our attention at the center of the forehead. This is a subtle center within our body system that the yogis called ajna. And when you put your attention there, you begin to draw life energy from the extremities of the body and center it at the ajna. And as you continue your focus there, the life energy builds at the ajna. It awakens that center and you feel a really deep sense of peace. And with that deep sense of peace, your mind becomes still. The more still your mind becomes, the more reflective it is of your higher nature. Even as a body of water, if it's being blown by the wind, creates waves. And then when the wind dies down, the lake becomes mirror-like and reflects everything that's above it, so that the trees, the mountains, the stars, the moon, the sky, all gets reflected in the lake. And even so, with your mind, as it becomes very, very still, it begins to reflect all the divine attributes that are natural . They just simply begin to become clear in your mind. So with these few techniques, breathing to the stomach, putting the attention at the center of the forehead, you can attain deep states of relaxation and illumination through the divine attributes. Peace, light, love, joy. These are your birthright and are natural and native to your deeper sense of self. That I would read from the Cross and Lotus Journal. Saint André Bessette, Montreal's miracle worker, lived 1845 to 1937, article by John Durkin. It is 1936 in Montreal, and a huge stone crypt forms the foundation of what is meant to be one of the world's great churches, indeed, one of the world's great buildings of any type. White walls soar to the sky, and pilgrims come from all over the world. There is no money for the enormous roof envisioned. Remember, the time is 1936, in the middle of the Depression. But there is no money for the enormous roof envisioned, the second largest dome in the world next to St. Peter's in Rome. The priests who founded and operate the College of the Notre Dame du Sacre-Cœur across the street, the same order which founded the Notre Dame University in Indiana, and who are building the Basilica, are meeting to see if there is any way to raise additional funds in Depression-torn Quebec, or whether the whole project will have to be abandoned. The doorkeeper for the college, a 90-year-old man without formal education, and the only brother in the order, also is at the table, although his name does not appear on any of the legal papers related to the basilica's construction. This doorkeeper cannot believe what he is hearing, this lack of understanding of how God arranges things. He asks the group to put a statue of St. Joseph in the middle of the unfinished building with the statement that, if St. Joseph wants a roof over his head, he'll provide it. 2 months later, the money has been donated and construction continues. The doorkeeper will not live to see its completion. Most North Americans of the time would have immediately recognized the doorkeeper as Brother André. On August 22, 1872, when he took his vows as a brother of the Clerics de Saint Croix, the priests of the Holy Cross, the only position for which he was qualified, either physically or in terms of education, was a general one of doorkeeper, janitor, barber, deliveryman, etc. As Brother André was making deliveries, he often encountered people who were ill. He would pray for these people and would rub the men and boys with oil taken from a lamp burning at the base of St. Joseph's statue in the college's chapel. If they were female, someone else did the rubbing. Sometimes these people were cured, but always they were strengthened both emotionally and in their understanding of the role of suffering in God's plan. Of course, word of these healings quickly spread. More and more people came for the help. One chapel after another were built, as the previous one became too small to accommodate the groups, leading eventually to the 1936 meeting to decide the fate of the oratory. One of my dear friends recalls his mother taking him to see Brother André when my friend was a child and very ill. I was about 10 or 11 years old when I got very sick with diphtheria. My parents called for a doctor to come and see me. He told my mom and dad that I would not live, because in the 1930s, there was no serum for that sickness yet. While my dad was at work and the other seven older children were at school, my mom decided to take me to the Oratory of St. Joseph to visit Brother Andre. As both of us were trying to walk up the high hill to the small original wooden chapel, my mom was very disappointed to see, while still far off, that a great number of people surrounded Brother Andre. There is no way to get near him. My mother then said, "Son, let us both go now to the big oratory, which was not complete at all, but was then used every day for Mass, and pray that you will get better." The next day, my mom and dad saw our doctor again. His first words were, "I just found out yesterday that they found a new serum for diphtheria. Unfortunately, the serum has not yet been tested yet, but I believe we should use it. Your little boy is going to die soon anyway." My mom and dad accepted. A few days later, I felt like a new boy, all healed. Brother Andre strongly objected to any claim that he healed. This objection was not humility, either real or otherwise, but rather a deep knowing that he did not heal anyone. He was just being accurate when he claimed repeatedly that only God healed. He also made clear distinction between healing and curing. God did not cure many of the people who came to see him in the sense of their difficulties left them, but rather they were strengthened in their understanding of God's love for them and how God's plan and how a human plan might not be the same. The healings often overshadow any understanding of Brother Andre's spirituality. He was a devoutly spiritual man, praying at every opportunity. He prayed long into the night, even having a small opening cut between his room and the college chapel so that he could be more deeply in the presence of God. He prayed because that is what he felt drawn to do more than anything else, not out of a sense of duty or in the anticipation of reward. His experience of God was not of some distant being. He stated that, quote, "God was present in all creation, and particularly in the human heart. Nothing but a thin veil separates us from God. When we pray to God, his ear is closer than our mouth," close quote. Brother Andre saw God as loving and constantly willing to look after us. He frequently stated, "The people are worried for nothing. God will give more than give us the help we need at the right time and the right place." He encouraged all to put themselves in God's hands, as God abandons no one. Brother Andre prayed to St. Joseph, to whom he had a particular devotion in a very unique manner. He reminded St. Joseph that he has also been a worker, a husband, and a father, sharing many of the same concerns as the people who came to Brother Andre. He asked St. Joseph to respond to these people as St. Joseph himself would have wanted to be helped. The prayer was not so much a petition as the presentation of a shared problem that St. Joseph would have experienced and would be very willing to assist with by asking his divine son for help. Brother Andre's prayer life often involved actions that he used to anchor his prayers. He buried medals and placed statues of St. Joseph in particular locations, rubbed people with oils or metals, and often asked those who came to him perform specific actions. These were not superstitious behavior, as he clearly and often stated that only God did anything. Rather, I think, they were physical and visual actions meant to deeply embed a prayer in the mind and in the heart. In addition to any prayers or actions, Brother Andre worked continuously to do the best of his ability what God placed in front of him at every moment. Brother Andre was canonized on October 17, 2010. Tens of thousands will come to his oratory, his little church, to celebrate the first anniversary of his canonization this October. A few may come to a deeper understanding of his spirituality. Some will be cured of physical and mental difficulties. All will in some measure be healed by their encounter with God's doorkeeper. I think it's lovely to read about this saint who was of such a humble position within the church. You're not talking about the person who ran the church or even a priest that everybody looked up to, but rather a very simple man. It reminds me of the story of Brother Lawrence. That's a particular favorite of mine. And when Brother Lawrence decided to join a monastery, he had been a soldier and a warrior before that, but had come to see that that was not the life for him, and he really wanted a life of deepened prayer and meditation. So he joined a monastery in a fairly remote area, and he was a big man, large hands, kind of meaty fingers. He couldn't do anything very well. He didn't have that many skills other than being a warrior, which wasn't called upon too much in a monastery. So they put him to work as somebody who washed the dishes, tended the garden, and since he tended to kind of break things and was rather clumsy, they thought maybe in the pots and pans that were all metal that he'd be all right. But he did a very simple thing. He just started to practice the presence of God, whether he was washing dishes or whether he was tending the garden. Whatever he was doing, he just practiced feeling the presence of God, wherever he's at, whatever he's doing. After many years of doing this, he indicated to a few who would ask of him what his practice was, and he would tell them something about it and something of his experiences. And so another monk from another monastery one day asked him to write to him in letters about his experiences of practicing the presence of God and how to do it and what Brother Lawrence's experiences were in doing this, so that this other brother would benefit from it. He wrote the letters, but with the promise by the monk that he would destroy these letters. Well, obviously, the monk didn't destroy the letters, because now they're published in books and distributed all over the world long after Brother Lawrence's life. And to the great benefit and upliftment of the world, here was this humble individual who was not high up in the church hierarchy, who did simple tasks in simple ways with total and complete integrity, who practiced this presence of God, and as a result of that, has gone out all over this world and changed the lives of thousands of people. So we can see through these two examples, Brother Lawrence and Brother Andre, that there is no accounting for where you may find a truly spiritual being. It may not be somebody who regularly goes to church. It may not be somebody who is at the top of the class in a spiritual institution or in an academic institution. It is the individual who has humility in their heart and has great love and a desire to know the truth. This desire to know the truth must be something that is embedded deeply within the soul of all of us, because we don't want to be sold a bill of goods. I know when I first came to this spiritual path that I was not interested in just learning a new language or a set of philosophies. But I wanted to know the truth. I had to know the truth. And that was the driving force in my life. And if I approached a teacher and it didn't promise the realization of truth, as a result, I didn't want to have anything to do with it. And if I didn't feel a change come over me, I remember I went to see a yogi who was famous at the time, Yogi Bhajan. And he entered into the room, and he was dressed in yogi's kind of clothing and with the turban head and all the rest of it. But as he spoke, I didn't feel any draw or attraction to him. I had been going to a yoga class that was taught by one of his disciples. And so I was interested, but I came and I didn't find anything about him that really lifted me closer to the goal that I was striving. I didn't have a real name for it. I didn't know what to call it. But it's something inside of me, and I went to different, what was called at the time a spiritual camp, and it was where these spiritualists would talk. A friend of mine took me to it, and they would talk and channel in different spirits and so on. And again, everything fell short of what I was looking for. It was interesting. Perhaps they were shams, perhaps not, but nevertheless, in either situation, they didn't really draw me. And so it was when I met Mother. And that was the transformative moment, because in her presence I felt something different. I felt uplifted. I felt changed. Now, in one way, I was completely the same, but in another way, I felt in touch with higher realms of consciousness that were not ordinarily available to me. And I remember that first meeting as if it was yesterday, even though it's been many, many years ago now, almost 40, I think, I'm counting correctly. And so I came into the room, and Mother was not yet entered into the room. And then as she came in and as she spoke, I felt a transformation within me. I felt as if I were in a spiritual windstorm. I felt such power emanating from her. And as she spoke, I didn't understand everything that she talked about. She talked about Christ consciousness, and she talked about God and God consciousness. And normally at the time, if anybody mentioned God, I was looking at for the nearest door to escape from. But somehow she used those words in a completely different kind of way. And they didn't offend me, and they didn't turn me off. I was intrigued by some of these concepts. What I didn't understand at the time was that what she was calling God was the experience that I was looking for and felt was absent. To me, God was something that was distant, that was in a book, that was something other people talked about, but I had no relationship with the word whatsoever. But through Mother's teachings and her experiences, I soon realized that what she called God was an experience that was an upliftment in consciousness, that was total purity and light and love and bliss. These were the things that I was craving in my life, even though at the time, as I say, I had no language, I had no words for them. But I wanted to know the truth above all. I could have had bliss perhaps, but if it wasn't the truth, I didn't want to have anything to do with it. And so I turned my mind toward the teachings, and I began to practice the things that she talked about. I began to meditate. I began to really focus my attention on going inside, and it's not easy because we don't have any background usually, particularly here in the West, for turning the mind inside. Everything's outside. Everything's out there. And if we're to find answers, we can find it in Wikipedia or in a book, so we think. But the more I searched into books, the more I knew I wasn't getting the nut. I was getting the shell, but not the nut inside. And what I craved was to taste the sweet meat of that nut. And so I wanted more and more of that. And as I practiced, I began to experience it. I remember sitting one of my first meditation sessions after meeting Mother. And somebody had given me a sheepskin. And Mother had said that it's good to put some kind of wool underneath you. So I took out this black sheepskin that had been given to me and And I sat on it, and I began to just watch my breath very simply, even as we started out tonight. It was a beautiful, sunshiny day. And I just felt such a wonderful sense of upliftment. I just felt such a wonderful sense of peace. And it was something that my soul deeply craved at the time. I just wanted more and more and more of that. And so down through the years, it's been an uphill and downhill kind of struggle. It doesn't come easy, this path of realization. Mother called it the path, pearl of great price, because we have to apply ourselves. We have to strive for it with all of our hearts, minds, souls, with all of our strength. And if we don't do that, then we only get partial results. But if we want the full results, then we have to apply ourselves completely, totally, thoroughly. But when we do, the most amazing things begin to happen. We feel a transformation begin. Again, in the first couple years after being with Mother, I sat in a meditation group. And as I did so, I was meditating along in a normal kind of a way, when suddenly I felt a snap at the base of my spine. And this tremendous force rushed up in my spine and went all the way to the center of my forehead at the ajna. And a tremendous heat began to build there. And as it built, I felt absolutely riveted to that spot on the center of my forehead. I couldn't take my attention away from it, even if I had tried, but I was fascinated. It was something outside of my control, but I felt somehow, perhaps because of Mother's teachings, that it was all right. And as this pure, powerful energy burned at the ajna, it was painful, and yet it was uplifting at the same time. And gradually the intensity of that experience began to go down, and the energy began to withdraw itself down through the spine and back at the spine, base of the spine. But I was thrilled to have the experience because it was confirmation of something that Mother taught. And so this began a long, long journey in which this powerful force at the base of the spine was to transform me from the inside out. In Jesus' teachings, He said that you do not pour new wine into an old wineskin. Apparently, the old wineskin will just come apart at the seams, and that was well known in His time. So if you have a new wine, you make a new wineskin. And a new wineskin, a new body in Christ, was being formed inside of me. Now, Christ is not a historical personage who lived 2,000 years ago only, but rather is a spiritual state of being, even as the term the Buddha. The Buddha was not the individual. The Buddha is a title for Siddhartha Gautama when he achieved a state of realization, and it means the awakened one, even as the Christ means the anointed one. It is the same thing. And as a result of that awakening, as a result of that anointing, this spiritual consciousness begins to grow. It's not a figment of imagination, and it's not something that you just read about in a book, then you parrot back. There are some who do that, but that's not the real thing. The real experience comes in such a profound way that this transformation that happens inside of you is undeniable even to your material mind. When we were here in Sunnyside 10 years ago, announced that Carla and I were going to be married. And immediately after our marriage in December, Carla went and started into these experiences, and this kundalini began rising up. That was from the very start. And these experiences were profound and they were powerful, and we traveled to Ananda Ashram in south of India. And there was Swami Satchidananda, and the spiritual vibrations that were there, these experiences continued, and she needed 24-hour care because these experiences were so powerful at the time. And her whole body was blazing with this fire, with this light. And as a result of that, that transformation began her own story into her own journey of truth. And this is a fact. This is a fact. So it's not just for one or two individuals. But when I traveled up and down India and all around, I asked many yogis, and some were saints that I met there. And I asked them about this Kundalini experience because Mother taught us in such explicit terms. And I was surprised that so many of them admitted that they had not had any such experience. They knew about it, they had read about it, they understood it from that standpoint, but they had not had an experience of it in itself. And then I thought of how many of those who were with Mother who had that awakening, and I realized what a tremendous gift had been imparted to us through Mother, because this is the means for transformation. Reading from Paramahansa Yogananda's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, and this comes from chapter 7. And there are these Gita verses that seem obscure until you understand them as Master describes them. Krishna speaking, I shall now declare unto thee, O best of Bharatas, Arjuna, the path, traversing which at the time of death yogis attain freedom, and also the path wherein there is rebirth. Fire, light, daytime, the bright half of the lunar month, the 6 months of the northern course of the sun, pursuing this path at the time of departure, the knowers of God go to God. Smoke, nighttime, the dark half of the lunar month, the 6 months of the southern course of the sun, he who follows this path obtains only the lunar light and then returns to earth. These two paths for exiting from the world are reckoned eternal. The way of light leads to release. The way of darkness leads to rebirth. Master's commentary. These mysterious stanzas, woefully misinterpreted by nearly all commentators, in reality contain symbolic references to the science of yoga. They describe the opening of the spiritual eye, the awakening of the cerebral spinal centers, and the ascension of life force and consciousness through them to the cosmic consciousness and liberation and spirit of the yogi who follows the way of light. And on the contrary, they describe also the descension or return to body consciousness or rebirth of those yet unable to open fully all the cerebral spinal doors that lead ultimately to spirit. Liberation, freeing the soul from physical, astral, and causal bodies, is the purport of these verses. The ponderous scriptures of the rishis have defined in veiled terms the labyrinth of the soul's descension and ascension. Krishna here has stated this portion of the science of yoga succinctly for the comprehending Arjuna, the advanced yogi devotee. The rudiments are follows: that the yogi who attains liberation must follow the path of fire. Here fire means the life energy, the kundalini power. The devotee's first scientific step towards emancipation is to gain control of his life force. In the ordinary man, the course of prana is downward, the way of darkness, flowing from the brain to the sensory nerves and the countless cells of the body. This dispersion and diffusion of life energy reveal to human consciousness the material world. In the successful yogi, on the other hand, the course of prana is upward, the way of light. By yoga, He reverses the direction of the flow and is able to concentrate the whole of his life force within the brain, in the sun of cosmic consciousness. In this way, God is revealed. The sun of cosmic consciousness is the supreme source of life, an intelligence in the body, with its abode in the seventh or highest spiritual center in the cerebrum, in the thousand-petal lotus, a sunburst as of a thousand suns. All life and faculties in the body evolve from this powerhouse of luminosity through its projected rays of the spiritual eye. Light in stanza 24 refers to the divine eye in the forehead, whose awakening enables the yogi to say with Christ, "I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have light of life." The light of the spiritual eye is a projection of the sun of cosmic consciousness. Through the light of the spiritual eye, the yogi moves along the spiritual path. Daytime is the manifestation of the spiritual eye during the samadhi state of meditation. This is the yogi's daytime, for he is awakened from the sleep of delusion. The bright half of the lunar month is that half of the advanced yogi's consciousness that remains awake and attuned to cosmic consciousness, even when the other half of his consciousness is asleep or active in the material world of delusion. A similar reference is made in chapter 2, verse 69. That which is right to all creatures is wakefulness to the man of self-mastery. And what is wakefulness to ordinary men, that is night to the divinely perceptive sage. The moon, whose light is reflected of the sun, has a bright fortnight, waxing period, and a dark fortnight, a waning period, in its month cycle. The sun of cosmic consciousness shining on matter, the light of the astral world and body that upholds and enlivens the material world and body, is here referred to as reflective or lunar light. In man, a miniature universe, its bright side is when it is spiritualized and turned towards cosmic consciousness, and its dark side is when it's turned towards delusion. In the advanced yogi, the cerebral spinal centers, though performing their activities that externally enlivens the body, necessitating their working through the instruments of nature or delusion, the outward flowing or dark side, remain nevertheless inwardly in a spiritualized or illumined state. When the yogi withdraws the external activities and enters samadhi through the light of the spiritual eye, this is the true bright fortnight, that period of the day when his whole being is inwardly ablaze, turned toward spirit, basking in the sun of cosmic consciousness. In other words, as you learn to turn the consciousness awareness within, an inner light illumines you. Now, for many years, when I close my eyes at nighttime and lay my head down onto the pillow, and everything on the outside of the world is darkened, I see a tremendous light illuminating the entire interior of the cranium. And when I first started to see this, I would think, oh, I left the light on, and I would open my eyes and see nothing but darkness. I would think that I needed to turn the light off. And then I would close my eyes again, and then I would see this tremendous illumination within me. Once I remember that I had taken into an experience where my internal vision was taken right into the center of my head, and I was looking up above, and the most beautiful blue light was emanating, and it seemed to curve like the sky does with the blue when it's a beautiful day out. But it didn't seem that there was any limit to the amount of blue light. There is a depth of field that just seemed to go on forever. And so this light, the gold, beautiful gold light of spirit, this deep blue light, and the pearlescent silvery white light are all reflections of this highest consciousness that is within you. It's the pure spirit within you. And when that awakens, you see it naturally. And it illumines your entire being as it grows inside of you. And it purifies you. And so when you are awakened in that way, this is the bright half of the lunar night or the lunar time within the month. And if those centers are not awakened and you do not have that awakened illumination, then that's the dark half of when the moon is getting darker and darker and darker. And so these are descriptions of what goes on inside every individual. And so as you open yourself to these experiences, they begin to prove themselves to you. And this is as it should be. And if we're finding ourselves in a state where we're not really going deeper, where we're really not having the experiences, then we need to reinvigorate ourselves. We need to apply ourselves and really begin to take seriously of why we are here. We're here to have this kind of realization. Now, we live in this world, so we live a life of balance. And it doesn't mean that we can't have some entertainment and that we don't work for a living and we don't have enjoyment in this world. All of those things are there. But we live that middle path. We live that life where we give to this world what it's due. But increasingly, we turn our attention more and more to this interior world because that's where this awakening really happens. And eventually, as that light grows inside of you, it becomes so strong that even when you open these two eyes and you go out into the work world or you're in your family life or any other time, you are still illumined with that same light. And now there is no difference as to whether your eyes are open or whether they are closed, whether you are meditating or whether you are walking around in this world. You are filled with that light. You are filled with the joy and the bliss and the illumination that comes with that awakening. And then you enter into the state of being the anointed one. As it says in the beginning of John, to all them who, to all them who received him, meaning the Christ, he gave them power to become the sons of God. To become a son of God means that this illumination is awakened inside of you. And now this light, this intelligent light, guides you, it directs you. It lifts you up. It is your constant companion and your friend. And you realize more and more completely that it is the soul life that animates you. It is the soul intelligence that operates through you. It is your all and all in all. And as a result of that transformation, you become a son of God, as is talked about in the New Testament scriptures. The Christ, the Son of God, is not meant for one individual only. It is a statement of who and what we truly are in a spiritual sense. And if we can receive that, not just intellectually, but we take it deep down into our being and it awakens us, then we become transformed and we are no longer the Son of Man, but we become the Son of God. Now, to some, this would be blasphemy, but it is the truth. And it is the truth that Jesus came to teach. And what is blasphemy, if you want to call it that, is this exclusiveness that only one individual was the Christ. It is a denial of the Christ in the world. Because that Christ is the firstborn in every one of us. Now, this is not just something that we can just say with certainty until we have experienced it. But when we have experienced it, we have every right to be able to proclaim it, not just for one, but for all. But it is the pearl of great price. We have to enter in if we are to really come to that place of realization. But if we do, our life will be changed and transformed in ways that are beyond comprehension in our current mode. But what we know is that it will be the fulfillment of our heart's desire, that we will feel that fulfillment, that union, that completion that we have yearned for from our first day here on earth, and that it is true. It is all true. So I'll just stop there and see if there's any questions about anything that I've spoken about today or about your own spiritual journey.
Until you actually, you can hear it over and over and over again. You know it's right.
Mm-hmm.
But until you know it's right,
right,
it's hard to accept.
Right.
And I just want to say it's very nice to know.
It makes all the difference.
It makes all the difference.
And we start out by, first of all, being receptive to what is true. What is true. But to mentally receive something is just really the beginning. And we hear the words, and as we proceed in realization, it takes us deeper and deeper, so that we can hear the same words and we can hear the same truth. But as we grow in realization, it takes on a much deeper meaning than what we thought we knew what it meant before. And then we have a certain experience and we think, oh my goodness, that was just a small portion of what it really is. And in one sense, our journey into realization is the never-ending story. Because as long as we retain any sense of individuality, there's this constant unfoldment that happens within the soul. We're always learning something new. We're always being taken into new vistas and being shown new truth or aspects of the same truth. And from a human standpoint, that can sound almost dispiriting. Well, you mean I don't get the whole thing? But what changes is you feel your union with God, with this divine spirit. And now it's just a journey of exploration, and it's fun, and it's interesting, and it's challenging, and it's everything that life is. But we no longer have that field of separation between ourselves and the divine. And that's the huge change that happens.
Yeah, and part of what I'm saying is God's been more, I can't think the correct word, but he's been expressing what realization means and what it is. And I'm very grateful for that, because it's like everything else you do, you have that process.
Right.
So it's the climb.
Yeah.
And it's for me personally, it's good.
Yeah. Somebody, after an experience that they had, they said, well, you always talk that God is everywhere. Mm-hmm. But after this experience, God really is everywhere. Why didn't you tell me? I mean, you did tell me, but why?
You know?
So there's a certain part of the brain that's not illumined yet, and when it becomes illumined, then it's more real than we could possibly have imagined before. More beautiful, more perfect, more of everything.
It goes beyond the word.
Yeah. That's wonderful. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, yeah. I'm very grateful.
Mm-hmm. And gratitude is one of the things that comes right on the heels of realization. It's just a tremendous sense of gratitude and humility, because you realize that as Jesus said, of myself I am nothing. It's my Father who does the works. And you realize that just even the life energy, our ability to breathe, to think, to do anything, is all animated by the divine consciousness. And of myself I am nothing. It makes total and complete sense to you then.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about, it kind of goes with what I was just saying, but I had it in question form when we were talking. It's simply just the work, we do the work, we do the work. It's always grace that brings it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the frustrating part sometimes. I mean, it's not really frustrating because it doesn't frustrate me anymore, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, it just seems like there's grace.
There's
God's grace that brings it. I can do the work.
There's two aspects to it. Is that we do have to do the work. If you imagine gardening, for instance, or farming or planting, you prepare the soil. That's a lot of hard work, just breaking up if it's sod or if it's so you have to prepare the soil. Add fertilizer to it, maybe spread the manure out, you water it, you do all this. And then finally you put the seeds in. And you have to do all of that to get a good crop. But then the ability of that seed to begin to shoot out some roots and then shoot up, you have nothing to do with that. And it's really miraculous when you think about it. As the cells are multiplying in there like crazy, and suddenly the seed turns itself right and knows how to send down roots where it's supposed to and reach up to the light in the way that it's supposed to. And then this tiny little seed can become a great tree and produce branches and shade and fruit and all sorts of things. And could we claim credit for any of that? Mm-hmm. Tremendous growth and not at all. And yet, you know, one of my favorite stories of the little boy who's out, he starts a garden, you know, back behind the church there. And he's working all summer and he digs up the ground and he plants the seeds and he waters and he fertilizers and he's pulling up the weeds. And one day the minister walks out the minister says, what a nice garden you and God have created. And the boy wasn't sure that he liked sharing the credit. He said, well, you should have seen the garden when just God had it. It didn't look so good then. So both are necessary, but we would never say that anything that we did in terms of preparing the soil and matched the miraculous occurrence that happens with the growth of the seed. So our part is necessary to prepare the soil and to make the conditions correct. But the seed is grace. And when that begins to grow inside of us, it is so clear that it is beyond our own doing. I could have never created this. I wouldn't have known how to create it. I wouldn't know how to make any of this happen at all. And yet, if I hadn't been cultivating the soil and making the conditions right, the seed of grace would not have grown in the way that it did. You should have seen it when just God had it. So it's this kind of mysterious relationship that our efforts are absolutely required. And yet we recognize that it is beyond our own efforts. Mm-hmm. And that really becomes clear when the seed begins to unfold and transforms us, and we know absolutely that it is from a power and intelligence way, way beyond our own, that our own can't even begin to touch it. It's way beyond what it takes to make a seed into a huge tree. And yet it happens inside of us. And that's the amazing thing about a human life, is that every human life has that seed in it. And yet how little that's recognized to this point in history. That so many who are espousing religion but fail to grasp that simple essence that that seed is within them, and that that transformation can occur. So that's yet to come, but it doesn't stop us, of course. You know, it's what we're here for.
Yeah.
You have to want it too.
You do.
You have to want it and do the work.
You absolutely do. And something has to awaken inside of you. Something, some urge,
part of
some.
You have to die. I read something. Part of you has to die before you can spiritually grow.
Mm-hmm.
Your old way of thinking has to be replaced.
That's the old wineskin. Yet you can't pour the new wine into the old wineskin. So our own preconceptions, our own attachments to the things of this world, things like that, they have to drop away, and something new comes about as a result. And so it challenges us on every level, because we don't want things to go away. We don't want things to drop off. We don't want that transformation, because we're not sure what's going to happen in its place. Are we going to like it? Do I lose control? What will happen? So it's this, like any adventure that we start out on, we start out in these high hopes, but in reality we don't know what the process exactly is going to look like for us. So there's this step of faith where we say, I don't know what it's all going to be about. I can't know. But I believe and I think this is the next thing. This is what I have to do.
Trust that it's better than what you
had. That's right.
Before.
That's right. And sometimes it's just the misery of what we do have that drives us, all right, enough.
Yeah,
I'm done with this. Whatever it is, I have to take that step. It has to be that strong, in a way. It has to grab us in some way, that it's almost like breathing.
Not instant gratification either.
No. A young aspirant once asked his guru, okay, so what's required in order to get this realization? He says, well, come on down with me. And he takes him down to the river. He says, now just walk out in the river with me. And he says, no, I just want you to just let me guide you here. So he just kind of gently takes him, but firmly, takes his head and he puts it underneath the water. And the young man's kind of thinking, oh, what's he doing here? And he's down there long enough, he can't breathe. And he's starting to run, and he starts to struggle. He starts to fight for his life. And that grip behind his head is strong and is not letting him up. And he's getting wild. He's just fighting with everything he can. And finally, the master lets him up. And he's gasping for air, and he's on the side of the banks. And the master says, now, when you want realization just as badly as you just wanted a breath, it'll be yours. So, only that much. So
it's tough to want it that bad. I mean, unless you're, I mean, unless things are really, really, if things go along smoothly, you kind of don't.
Yeah, yeah. Then if the urge isn't there, mm-hmm. we can ask for that desire to grow inside of us. We can open ourselves to it. And just simply opening ourselves, just saying, I really want to feel that. And I want to have that attraction toward God as much as I do towards chocolate ice cream. You know. Or to the Seahawks winning, you know, the championship, or whatever it is that's the passion in our life, you know. As much as I want that, I want realization even more. And if we had that kind of desire, then there's no obstacle that we wouldn't be willing to cross. There's nothing we wouldn't be willing to do. So it is that desire that is the essence of our spiritual journey. And if we don't have it, we can't pretend to it. So, but we can open ourselves to it, and we can issue a prayer for it. But let this be my desire, greater than any of my other desires.
Mm-hmm.
And that does work. It absolutely does. Doesn't happen always as fast as we want it to, but seeds don't grow overnight. They grow in their own time, they grow in their own way, and we have to be willing to keep ourselves. That's a wonderful analogy that Yogananda used to one of the Gita commentaries. It's in the journal. A man planted a flower seed in his garden. He looked after it, steadfastly weeding and watering the soil around it. A robust plant appeared, but for years, no flower. He thought of destroying the plant, but firmly decided, "My business is to look after the plant. It is for God to produce the flower. I will keep myself busy in tending the plant and not on concentrating on my flower's labors." Years passed. He contented himself with the care of the plant and forgot all about the flower. One sunny morning, when a breeze was gently blowing, he smelled a strangely attractive fragrance. He ran to his plant and stood speechless in joy. There in front of him was the gorgeous flower. The aromatic beauty had always been present in the plant. A hidden potential awaiting the right moment of blossoming, made possible by his labor of love. The yogi should similarly keep himself busy, nurturing his plant of self-realization. If he is not impatient, if he will find one day, when God in his infinite wisdom deems it proper, the aromantine flower of eternal freedom. Swami Maharshi used to say, "Striving, striving, striving, behold, one day the goal." And if we let go of digging up the plants, digging up the seed, and examining it and seeing whether it's growing, and which only destroys the seed or slows down its process, we just work on making the conditions perfect for that seed to grow. And knowing that one day when it's the season is right, it will grow, and it'll be more than we ever imagined that it could be. And that is the secret to what Krishna calls actionless action. We're not attached to the end results. We're just simply intent upon doing the action as perfectly as we can. So if we close our eyes and go within and breathe to our stomach, and then focus our attention at the point between the eyebrows and the forehead. Just let our eyes gently roll up and bring our whole attention there, and then look for that beautiful light. If you want to visualize it, you can see it as a cave, if you will. It's about 50 feet across. Only this cave is not dark. It's filled with the most beautiful golden aura of light. And as you consciously sail through that tunnel of light, of gold light, you come before another tunnel that is 25 feet across. And it's a deep, dark blue. And you sail through that tunnel of light. And as you do so, you come to a place where you see a tiny star of light. It's a white, pearl, silvery light that is shining like a star. And it's radiating. And you can move into that beautiful white light and merge into an ocean of light. And as you see that ocean light extending out and out and out, so does your awareness go with it. And you feel yourself merged into this great ocean of light. And you can feel there a tremendous sense of peace, an equanimity of mind. There is no place to go. There is nothing to do. There is only a complete state of being.